Good evening, everybody. My name's Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE. Can I welcome everyone here to the lecture tonight? I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Peter Singer to the London School of Economics. Peter Singer is internationally celebrated, among other things, for his book on animal liberation, which came out in the mid-1970s, and of course for his continuing work in bioethics concerning life and death decisions in medicine. I'd like to mention in particular one book of his that influenced me a lot, which was called Rethinking Life and Death. Professor Peter Singer is at the Center for Human Bioethics at Monash University. He lectured at Oxford in the 1970s and then spent a period in the United States. Since 1977, he's been at Monash and held various posts associated with the Center for Bioethics there. He is a fellow both of the Academy of Humanities and the Academy of the Social Sciences in Australia. Peter Singer has a long-standing interest in evolutionary theory and its implications for ethics and politics. This was evident in his book, The Expanding Circle, published in 1981. And a dozen years later, it inspired his book, How Are We to Live? Ethics in an Age of Self-Interest, which came out in 1993. The relationship between evolutionary theory and political thinking is the subject of his talk today. The time has come, Peter Singer believes, for the left. I'll be interested to hear if he thinks there still is a coherent left, but for the left to take seriously the view of human nature that is suggested by Darwinian theory. The lecture that Peter Singer is giving today will be published in a volume, or a series of volumes, called Darwinianism Today, which is a series of short essay-length books that grew out of the Darwin program at the LSE, which Helena Cronin has so ably organized. This series will be launched in October 1998 and will be published by Weidenfeld Nicholson. The first of the annual Darwin LSE public lectures was given by John Maynard Smith, who I believe is in the audience tonight. That will also be published in the series in the first batch in October. Peter Singer's book will be coming out in the second batch in the spring of October now, of 1999. I'm very happy, therefore, to introduce Professor Singer to bring together, I think, two disparate strands, really, in social and political thinking: the impact of evolutionary theory, and especially recent advances in evolutionary theory, and problems of rethinking politics. I now turn over the floor to him.
Thank you very much, Anthony Giddens, for that introduction, and thank you also to Helena Cronin for the invitation to be here and to give this lecture, which I'm delighted and honoured to do. In 1874, Karl Marx read Bakunin's book Statism and Anarchy, and in reading it, he copied out passages and made some annotations on them, so that the resulting manuscript, unpublished of course, reads a bit like a debate between the foremost anarchist and the foremost communist of the 19th century. I'm going to show you a little bit of that because it's relevant to my theme. In this passage, Marx has copied something from Bakunin attacking the idea of universal suffrage, which Bakunin as an anarchist doesn't support. And he says that it will consist of rule of the majority by a privileged minority. But the Marxists say this will consist of workers. Yes, says Bakunin, but ex-workers, who once they become only representatives or rulers of the people, cease to be workers. Marx's comment is here. He says they don't cease to be workers any more than a manufacturer ceases to be a capitalist when he becomes a member of a municipal council. Bakunin then says, this is really the continuation, of course, of that passage, from the heights of the state they begin to look down upon the whole common world of the workers. From that time on, they represent not the people, but themselves and their own claims to govern the people. And this is the important line: those who can doubt this know nothing at all about human nature. Marx is very scornful of that suggestion. If Bakunin were familiar just with the position of a manager in a workers' cooperative, he could send all his nightmares about authority to the devil. Well, the tragedy of the 20th century, perhaps, is that Marx was wrong about that, that Bakunin's nightmares about authority were indeed very real. And that can serve as an opening, I think, to the need to take seriously, for those of us on the left to take seriously, the idea of human nature and not dismiss it as facilely as I believe Marx did in those remarks. Because the left certainly needs a new paradigm. The collapse of communism and the abandonment by democratic socialist parties of the traditional socialist objectives of national ownership of the means of production, perhaps even one could say of the abandonment of democratic socialism as it was understood, has deprived the left of the goals that it cherished over the last two centuries and in which it grew to a position of great political power and influence. My focus here, though, is not so much with the left as party political left, but rather as a broad body of thought, as a spectrum of ideas about achieving a better society. And the left, in that sense, is urgently in need of new ideas and new approaches. I want to suggest that one source of new ideas that could revitalize the left is an approach to human, social, political, and economic behavior based firmly on a modern understanding of human nature. It's time, in other words, for the left to take seriously the idea that we have evolved from animals and that we bear the evidence of this inheritance not only in our anatomy and our DNA, but in what we want and how we try to get it. In other words, it's time to try to develop a Darwinian left. I'm going to give you some headings for what I'm going to say we'll forget about that one. I don't seem to have that transparency, sorry. Or else I have it somewhere else. The heading to this section was to be what is essential to the left. And that is a question on which I could, of course, give... I do have this transparency, if you really want to see it, now that I've told you. That obviously could be the title for an entire lecture and indeed a book, but I'm going to answer it in a very personal way, and that is by telling you about a friend of mine who has been on my mind because, in fact, over the past year, I've completed a book about him as well as a television documentary. His name is Henry Spira, and I'm sure that name will not be recognized by most of you in the movement. But he is the most remarkable person that I've worked with, not worked academically with. When he was 12 years old, his family was living in Panama. His father had fallen on hard times and was basically taken in by a wealthy friend and given a couple of rooms in a huge mansion that this wealthy friend owned, which in fact took up an entire city block. While Henry was staying in this mansion, he got friendly with some of the people who worked for the man who owned it. And one day they asked him, he was 12 years old at the time, as I say, if he would like to come with them when they went down into the city to do some work for the boss. What in fact they were doing was collecting rents from the people who lived in slums in the city blocks, and they were collecting them at gunpoint. The impression this made on Henry, I think, made him part of the left thereafter. He felt somehow that this wasn't the way things ought to be. He moved later to the United States, where he became a Trotskyist for a time, joined the Maritime Union, which had some Trotskyist influence, became a merchant seaman, served on ships, tried to fight against corrupt union bosses in the union, went down to the south to report on the first efforts by blacks to gain civil rights, to boycott buses because they couldn't sit in the same seats as whites, wrote about these things for leftist newspapers, left the Trotskyists because eventually he decided they had lost touch with reality and were just talking to themselves, was blacklisted during the McCarthy era, went to teach kids in ghetto schools, and then, as if that wasn't enough for one lifetime, in 1973 read an article that I'd written about animal liberation, which is where I came into the picture, and decided that animals also belonged to the exploited, the oppressed, and those who needed someone to defend them. I think his life has been a kind of ostensive definition of being on the left. And when you ask him about why he spent more than half a century working for these causes, he says simply, he's on the side of the weak, not the powerful, of the ridden, not the rider. And I think that is what the left is really all about. He's trying to reduce the universe of pain and suffering that exists out there as he sees it, to try to do what he can to make that less. And I think if we shrug our shoulders at that, if we say we're indifferent to the fact that the weak and the poor get ripped off and exploited by those who already have comfortable or more than comfortable lives, then if we're indifferent to that, we're not part of the left. If we want to change that situation in a serious way towards a more egalitarian direction, I believe we are. Of course, another topic for a book would be exactly what kind of egalitarian society the left should aspire to. But there are perhaps already more than enough books on that. Let's just say that we live in a world in which the 400 richest people have a combined net worth greater than 45% of the world's population, greater than 2.3 billion people. And over a billion people have to manage to live on less than the equivalent of one US dollar per day. I think given those kinds of facts, there are a number of different principles of justice or equality or forms of utilitarianism which would agree that we ought to try and do something about a more egalitarian distribution of resources. Right, well, that's roughly what I mean by the left, and therefore roughly deals with that issue that we had as a heading. What I now want to do is to turn to the question of Darwinism and look here at three ways in which you can invoke Darwinian thinking in a political debate. First, the idea that the direction of evolution is itself good or right. And about that, I think one can simply say that that's a clear fallacy, what philosophers may call the fallacy of deducing values from facts or an ought from an is. There is Darwinian thought is a scientific theory. It's a description, and there is no ethical or moral direction in the direction of evolution. So I think we can get rid of that for a start. Sorry, we've got a false number there. We'll renumber that one too. This view is something that has been invoked in politics, particularly in the 19th century by social Darwinists, for example, that social policies like welfare policies, for example, might help the less fit to survive. I think the social policies that may actually affect the genes of the future population most explicitly would be medical policies. For example, the discovery of insulin undoubtedly has meant that there are more diabetics in the community, more people who require insulin, because otherwise not so many diabetics would have survived and reproduced. But while in those very limited contexts there may be some truth to this view, I don't think anyone wants to withhold insulin for fear of those terrible genes spreading. So in the broader social context, of course, being on welfare isn't something for which, as far as we're aware, there is a genetic component. There's no doubt a wide range of factors anyway at stake, and there's no sense in which one could regard those sorts of policies, I think, as having deleterious genetic consequences. It's the third of the assertions that I want to focus on and that I think is the most interesting. This third assertion is that we need to understand human nature in order to assess that price that we may have to pay for achieving some of our values, and those may include some of these goals of a more egalitarian society. So I'm going to come back to that aspect, that third assertion, in a moment. But first I want to talk about something else as the next heading. And look at the history of some of this discussion. Marxists generally have been enthusiastic about Darwin's account of the origin of species, as long as its implications for human beings are confined to anatomy and physiology. In fact, in his speech at Marx's graveside, Engels paid Darwin a unique compliment. He compared Marx's great discovery of the materialist theory of history with Darwin's discovery about the law of the development of organic nature, as Engels put it. But in that characterization, there lurks, in fact, the dawn of a mistaken idea, the idea that Darwinian evolution stops at the dawn of human history and the materialist theory of history takes over. The materialist theory of history implies that there is no fixed human nature. Human nature changes with every change in the mode of production. It has already changed in the past, for example, between primitive communism and feudalism, between feudalism and capitalism, and it can change again in the future. But for anyone who sees a continuity between human beings and our non-human ancestors, it's at least puzzling that the laws of evolution should hold for natural history but stop at the dawn of human history. Belief in the malleability of human nature, however, is very important for the left. It's important because it's provided grounds for hoping that a different kind of human society is possible. And here's the real reason why the left rejected Darwinian thought, I believe. Darwinian thought dashed the left's great dream, the dream of the perfectibility of humankind. Since Plato's Republic, at least, the idea of building a perfect society has been present in Western consciousness. For as long as the left has existed, it's sought a society in which all human beings live harmoniously and peacefully with each other in a free society. For Darwin, on the other hand, the struggle for existence seems to be unending, a long way from the dream of the perfectibility of humankind. If the materialist theory of history is correct and social existence determines consciousness, then the greed, egoism, personal ambition and envy that a Darwinian might see as inevitable aspects of our nature as the descendants of beings who've survived the struggle for existence can instead be seen as the consequences of living in a society with private property and private ownership of the means of production. If there were no private property and the means of production were communally owned, people would no longer be so concerned about their private interests. Their nature would change. They would find their happiness in working cooperatively with others for the communal good. Thus, we can overcome the conflict that occurs between human beings in existing societies, but only if this conflict is a product of the economic basis of society rather than an inherent aspect of our biological nature. So that, I think, is where the left went wrong about Darwinism. The next question I want to ask is this one. Can the left accept a Darwinian view of human nature? In the 20th century, the dream of the perfectibility of mankind, humankind, turned into the nightmares of Stalinist Russia and of the Cultural Revolution in China and of Cambodia under Pol Pot. From these nightmares, the left awoke in turmoil. True, there have been attempts to create an egalitarian society that have had less terrible results. Perhaps one could instance Castro's Cuba or the Israeli kibbutzim. But there have been none that one could describe as an unqualified success. The dream of perfectibility, I think, should be put behind us, at least for the foreseeable future. And with that, one barrier to the Darwinian left has been removed. Another barrier that has already been partially dismantled is the intellectual hold of Marx's theory of history. Marx has quite properly had an immense influence on the social sciences. In directing our attention to the links between a society's economic base and its laws, religion, politics, and culture generally, Marx shattered the illusion of the independence of ideas and culture and opened up a new and very fruitful area for research, And I certainly don't think we ought to abandon Marx's insight there, but we should make it part of a much larger picture. It's time to recognise that the mode of production can influence our ideas, our politics and our consciousness, but only within broad limits already set by our biological inheritance. The remaining barrier to the acceptance of Darwinian thinking by the left is that idea of the malleability of human nature. Though, as we've seen, this idea is supported by the materialist theory of history, the idea of the malleability of human nature actually goes beyond the Marxist camp. It's broader than that. And non-Marxist reformers, too, will often accept a view that of malleability, perhaps one that stems from John Locke's idea of the mind as a tabula rasa, or as a white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. From that it follows that education, perhaps, is the way to change society. Education is the path to reform, the great panacea. So these beliefs about the malleability or otherwise of human nature do vary along the left-right continuum. But they are beliefs about a matter of fact, about a matter of fact, not about values, and so they should be open to revision in the light of the evidence. That evidence can come from history, anthropology, ethology, and evolutionary theory. But it's not easy, of course, to look at such evidence without ideological blinkers. In 1975, when E.O. Wilson published Sociobiology, The New Synthesis, this was an extremely controversial and hotly debated, very much politicised idea. Since then, many books have been published concerning universal aspects of human nature that have had far less stormy births. And Wilson's own very recent book, Consilience, has also had a less stormy launching just in the last week or so. So in the hope that we have matured in our willingness to consider such ideas, I now want to put forward the totally unoriginal proposition that while some areas of human life show great diversity, in others human behaviour stays fairly constant across the whole range of human cultures and is also shared with our closest non-human relatives. So I think the left can accept a Darwinian view of human nature, but I think it has to look then at this question: what is fixed and what is variable in human nature? Now, this is, again, an enormous topic that I'm going to be pretty dogmatic about and say some things very briefly that could be very much debated, but I think it's better to say something than nothing. I'd suggest we could profitably divide human nature into three categories: those that show great variation across culture, those that show some variation across culture, and those that show little or no variation. In the first category of great variation, I'd suggest perhaps the way we produce our food, we're very flexible in that, gathering, hunting and gathering, growing crops, raising domestic animals, all very different, all leading to different modes of settled or nomadic forms of human civilization, related to different economic structures perhaps and different religious practices, and perhaps also different forms of government. I think all of those things vary greatly, although the existence of some form of government, and here's where I can't accept Bakunin's view, does seem to be pretty much universal. In the second category, those that show some significant degree of variation, but not so much, also some common factors, I'd put sexual relationships. Victorian anthropologists were very much impressed when they left Victorian England by the variety of sexual relationships they encountered. And for some time, the view prevailed that this is just a cultural matter, the forms of sexual relationships that societies have. And of course, it's true that there are important differences. There's a major difference between monogamous societies and polygynous societies, undoubtedly. But all societies have some marriage systems in which there is some sanctions on sexual relationships outside the marriage bond, although they vary in their severity. And it's notable that there are virtually no societies that allow many husbands to one woman, polyandrous societies. Those that there are, very rare, seem to be in rather temporary and special kinds of economic circumstances. And whatever the rules of marriage may be, certainly some things seem to be constant, including infidelity and sexual jealousy going with it, seem to be universal elements of human sexual behaviour. Also into this middle category, I would put ethnic identification and its converse, xenophobia and racism. I happen to live in a society, Australia, which fortunately is very tolerant of diverse cultures. But I know that racism nevertheless is there in many Australians. The potential is there to be stirred up by demagogues, as happens from time to time. And we have seen in the former Yugoslavia the way in which peoples who lived together in apparent peace for 40, 50 years perhaps, nevertheless have latent racist ethnic feelings lurking there. So I think we know that while racism can be learned and unlearned in a sense, the racist demagogues who stir it up are holding torches over material that is inherently fairly inflammatory. Now I come to the third category, that in which there is little variation across cultures. Here I'd place, for example, the fact that we are social beings. Very few humans live entirely alone, and that we're particularly concerned for the interests of our kin. Our readiness to form cooperative relationships and to recognise reciprocal obligations, I think, is another universal. Perhaps more controversially, I'd suggest that the existence of hierarchy or a system of rank in a society is a near universal tendency. Contrary to Rousseau and many others, I don't think equality is the natural state of humanity, nor is it the default state to which human societies will return if only you can rid them of distorting influences. There are very few human societies without differences in social status, and when you do try to get rid of them, they tend to re-emerge very rapidly. Finally, gender roles also show relatively little variation. It's another controversial point, of course, but women do always have the major role in caring for young children in every society, while men are much more likely than women to be involved in physical conflict, both within the group and in warfare between groups. And men tend to have a disproportionate role in the political leadership of the group. So there are common human tendencies that transcend cultural variation. Of course, as I say, culture does have an influence in sharpening or softening even those tendencies that are most deeply rooted in our human nature. And there are variations between individuals. Nothing I've said is contradicted by the existence of individuals who don't care for their kin, or of couples in which the man looks after the children while the woman serves in the army. I must also stress, of course, that this rough classification of human behaviour carries no evaluative overtones. I'm not at all saying that because something like hierarchy or male dominance is characteristic of almost all human societies, that therefore it's good or acceptable, or we shouldn't attempt to change it. My point is rather the one that was made, the third point on those aspects in which Darwinian thought can be influential in politics, that of estimating the price we may have to pay for achieving some of these goals. To be blind to the facts about human nature is to risk disaster. Consider hierarchy as an example. Knowing that human beings are under a wide range of conditions, have a tendency to form hierarchies, should warn us that abolishing particular hierarchies is not necessarily going to prevent others from re-emerging. If, for example, as during the French Revolution, you abolish the aristocracy, you are likely to get another hierarchy emerging based perhaps on economic wealth. If, as during the Russian Revolution, you abolish both the aristocracy and possession of private wealth, you will still get another hierarchy emerging, in this case based on power and influence within the Communist Party. Overlooking that, I believe, is, as I say, a recipe for things to go badly wrong. It's very easy to say, as Trotskyists, for example, said, that Stalin betrayed the revolution, and that's why everything went wrong. But before Stalin came to power, Lenin himself, of course, had set up an authoritarian rule, and Trotsky's own position was hardly free from authoritarianism, as anyone who has read the early history of the period will know. The point, though, is not what individual Bolsheviks did in those times or individual revolutionaries in other circumstances. The point is what egalitarian revolution has not been betrayed to some degree by its leaders, and why do we dream that the next revolution could be any different? What this shows, again, not that hierarchy is inevitable, but that getting rid of it will not be as easy as previous revolutionaries have imagined. To grapple with these facts, to understand them, the left has to understand our nature as evolved beings. So let's move then to this topic. How can reformers on the left, I take it as what we are rather than revolutionaries all nowadays, learn from Darwin? If you give a piece of timber to a woodcarver, he doesn't just begin to carve it from an abstract pattern in his head of the object he or she wishes to make, but rather woodcarvers will examine the grain of the timber and see in what way they can fashion a bowl or whatever else it is that they wish to make out of it, modifying the design to suit the timber. Political philosophers and reformers and revolutionaries, though, all too often have gone about it the other way. They've had this blueprint, this scheme, which they've sought to impose on the timber of human nature without really looking at it or understanding what it was like. In part, of course, as I've already said, because they believed, in any case, it would be utterly changed by the revolution they were planning to bring about. There are different ways of working with the grain of human nature. The market economy is one. It's based on the idea that human beings can be relied upon to further their own interests, particularly their economic interests. As Adam Smith so famously said, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher that we expect our dinner, but from his regard to his self-interest. To serve our own interests better, according to this model, we'll strive to produce better goods than our competitors or produce equally good goods more cheaply. So, as you all know, the hidden hand works together for the common good. It's a view that was put forward succinctly by Garrett Hardin in his book The Limits of Altruism, when he wrote that public policies should always be based on an unwavering adherence to the cardinal rule, never ask a person to act against his own self-interest. And the current economic fashion for privatising corporations or previous state monopolies is consonant with this way of thinking. If the community owns the monopoly, it's not going to work efficiently. The managers have no interest in it doing well. Their economic interest and that of the monopoly will pull in opposite directions, and you have at best inefficiency, at worst widespread corruption. So privatising it means that the managers are rewarded in accordance with their performance and it'll run more efficiently. Well, that's one way of tailoring your institutions to human nature. But it's not the only way of doing so. Even within that rule of not asking someone to act against his or her self-interest, you can ask, well, what do we really mean by self-interest? Do we have to interpret it in a narrow economic framework? The acquisition of material wealth beyond at least a relatively modest level has little to do, at least in a society like ours, with self-interest in the biological sense of maximising the number of descendants that you leave in future generations. That may not always have been true, particularly in societies that allowed polygamy. But today, even if perhaps a wealthy playboy can have more girlfriends than someone who can't, they're likely to be using contraception anyway. It's also been said often enough that money isn't going to buy you happiness. So if self-interest consists in living a fulfilling or happy life, we needn't think of self-interest in strictly economic terms. So perhaps we can think our way into some different model than the market model by encouraging a broader sense of self-interest, one in which we seek to build on the social and cooperative side of our nature rather than the individualistic and competitive side. A cooperative society, I believe, will be more in keeping with the values of the left than a narrowly competitive one. While encouraging the pursuit of economic self-interest has perhaps contributed to raising the material wealth of societies, it's also widened the gap between the well-off and the have-nots. Greater wealth for the upper and middle class does not make up for the increased human misery brought to the poor. And in any case, both national and international surveys show that the level of material wealth of a society beyond a certain point has little to do with reported self-evaluation of happiness or how fulfilled or content people are in societies. The competitive society, carried to extremes, encourages us to look at life like the T-shirt once worn by the Wall Street entrepreneur Ivan Bersky. He who has the most toys when he dies wins. But if what we're after is a cooperative society, then we're not going to see life as a zero-sum game of that sort. Fortunately, modern Darwinian thought does not see success or self-interest as simply competition in that narrow sense. The struggle for existence in Darwin's language also in the modern terminology includes cooperation as well as competition. And here I want to refer to Robert Axelrod's famous work on the prisoner's dilemma, which provides a basis for building a more cooperative society. The prisoner's dilemma is an example of a situation in which two people can each choose whether or not to cooperate with the other. The catch is that each does better individually by not cooperating, but if both make this choice, then both will be worse off than they would have been if they'd both chosen to cooperate. In other words, the outcome of rational, self-interested choices by two or more individuals can make all of them worse off than they would have been if they had not pursued their own interest. The individual pursuit of self-interest can be collectively self-defeating. Well, we're all familiar, I think, with such situations. If you commute to work, you know that you'd all be better off if you left your cars at home and took the bus, which could speed swiftly down uncrowded roads. But as long as everyone else is using their car, it's not in your interest to take the bus, because the roads are still going to be as choked as they ever are, and you'll be even slower on the bus than you would be in your own car. What Axelrod was interested in was strategies of cooperating and what strategies could bring the best results for parties who face repeated prisoner's dilemma type situations. Should they, for their own good, individually, always take what seems to be the individually selfish choice, not cooperating, defecting, as Axelrod called it, or should they cooperate? And what Axelrod did is to invite people to send in various strategies which he ran against each other in a kind of computerized tournament to see which one would do better. And what came out of that is a very simple strategy called tit for tat, which says, start each new encounter with a new player by making the cooperative move. After that, always do on your next move what the other player did on his or her previous move. So if the other player cooperates, you just keep cooperating all the way through if you have two people running tit for tat as a strategy. But if the other one does not cooperate, then you retaliate by not cooperating until the other one cooperates again. Now those results, which have been supported by more recent work in the field, can serve as a basis, I think, for social planning that can appeal to the left. Anyone on the left should welcome the fact that the best strategy, in individual terms even, is to begin every encounter cooperatively. Some members of the more idealistic left may regret the tit-for-tat doesn't continue to cooperate no matter what. But if you understand Darwin here, you know that, in fact, the fact that tit-for-tat does retaliate if provoked is essential to its success and essential also to the creation of a more cooperative society. The point is that those who defect, those who don't cooperate, can continue to prosper if there are people who will cooperate with them even while they continue to take the selfish, the narrowly selfish, short-sighted choice. And only if there is some negative payoff for them will they not prosper. As Richard Dawkins has put it, you need to have suckers for cheats to flourish. What we need to do then, as social reformers perhaps, is to set up the conditions for so that tit-for-tat can be a successful strategy for everyone to adopt. We need to deal with problems like that of scale in our present society, very different from that in which human beings spent most of the years of their evolution. Tit-for-tat can't work in a society of strangers who will never encounter each other again, or won't recognise each other if they do. So what we have to do is to think of setting up structures in which people come into regular contact with each other in small groups rather than these huge, highly mobile societies that we have and perhaps are going to increasingly have given the globalisation of the world economy. And that, I think, is a promising area for further research. The next problem, perhaps even more difficult to overcome, is that tit-for-tat isn't going to work if I'm so powerful that there's nothing that you can do to make me to make me worse off. So the direction that society is going in, growing gaps between the rich and the poor, is not a direction that will encourage cooperative strategies among all members of the society. So I think what we need to do then is to try and find ways to look at these problems, to overcome them if we possibly can. Darwinian thinking is going to say that we are not likely to be naturally altruistic, but perhaps we can do some things to promote, nevertheless, by cultural means, the greatest amount of altruism that we can. We can set up cultural devices that play an important part in providing rewards and punishment for behaviour that is altruistic or not to proportionally. And I think that we already do this to some extent, and in fact we already work, of course, with systems that encourage altruism. But the problem perhaps is that in our society the rewards seem to be those of consumption, those of high status consumption. And we value perhaps people who can live that kind of lifestyle, who consume the most and perhaps leave behind them the biggest pile of waste. And of course that waste is not just related to physical garbage, but is related also to the consumption of energy, and what that means is contributions to global warming, given the kinds of energy we have, and that actually makes people significantly worse off in the poorest countries of the world, who will not be able to match our levels of energy consumption unless they're going to have really drastic climate change over the next century or so. Well, let me try and draw this lecture to a close, because I do want us to have some time for discussion. So let me just put in point form some of the things that a Darwinian left would and would not do. summing up what I've been saying then, a Darwinian left would not deny the existence of a human nature, would not insist that human nature is inherently good, nor that it's infinitely malleable. A Darwinian left would not expect to end all conflict and strife between human beings, either by political revolution, social change, or education. And it would not assume that all inequalities are due to discrimination, prejudice, oppression, or social conditioning. They may be. Many of them may be, but one cannot assume that that is the case in all cases. What would a Darwinian left do more positively? A Darwinian left would accept that there is such a thing as human nature and seek to find out more about it, so it can be grounded on the best available evidence of what human beings are like, would, as I've already said, reject an inference from what's natural to right, no fallacious is to ought deductions. Expect that whatever the social and economic systems you have, people will act competitively in various ways to enhance their own status, gain power, and or advance their interests and those of their kin. Expect that irrespective of the social and political system in which they live, most people will respond positively to invitations to enter into mutually cooperative arrangements. This is the tit-for-tat strategy, as long as they can see that the invitations are, in fact, genuine. Because there is a lot of evidence, which I didn't have time to go into, that this has played an important role in our evolution and in our nature. Just three more of these points. And a Darwinian left would promote structures that foster cooperation rather than competition, attempt to channel competition into socially desirable ends. And this is one that I just felt I had to throw in, although it's not really part of the structure of the lecture and it doesn't really relate to anything that I've had time to say, but I do think the Darwinian understanding reduces the gulf that we have put, for various reasons, between humans and other animals, and I think it suggests that it's not an accident, perhaps, that as I said in describing the life of my friend Henry Spira, that animals also come into the purview of the left as an oppressed group who need our assistance against ruthless exploitation. And finally, for the point form, standing by the traditional values of the left and being on the side of the oppressed and weak, but thinking carefully about how the changes that we want to make can actually bring them the greatest benefits. Now, I think that on that basis, we can move forward. It's a deflated vision of the left, perhaps, but it's a realistic one, and it is still, I think, distinctively a vision of the left. I said at the beginning at one point in the lecture, that this is, I think, as much as can happen for the foreseeable future. And I use the word foreseeable just to make the point that, of course, in the longer run, our biology may not, after all, be fixed. We are the first beings who have understood our evolutionary roots, our evolutionary past, have understood how we come to be what we are. And for that reason, we may become the first beings to actually take control of the mechanism that makes us what we are. In other words, our genes. Now, I'm not saying that this is something for the left really even to think about very seriously at present, because we are a long way from the sorts of knowledge and understanding that even could, if we wanted to, lead us to genetically engineering a better society. And indeed, even if we could do that, we may well wish not to have that sort of knowledge, because we may think it's too dangerous to have. But I simply mention the possibility is there that at some future time, maybe those more utopian dreams of the left may be within our power. Thank you very much.
We've got about a quarter of an hour for questions, if anyone would like to pose them. Start with that. I don't know if there's a roving mic at all, is there? You just have to speak up if you could, so that people right at the back could hear.
I think it is that Trotsky said that far easier to blame the supposed inadequacies of the working class in the Russian Revolution.
Can you speak up a bit?
Yeah. It's far easier to blame the supposed inadequacies of the working class. struggle wage against the rise of Stalinism, in which hundreds of thousands of people, loyal to the original principles of the revolution, sacrificed their lives. And whether you acknowledge it or not, that's where the violent cuts is.
Did people hear the question?
No.
Oh, right, okay. I'll try to summarise the question. The questioner suggested that Trotsky had explained through his analysis of bureaucracy the inadequacies of the Stalinist view, and the questioner suggested that this was not a matter of human nature as such, but in fact hundreds of thousands of people struggled against Stalinism and lost their lives in doing so. And the questioner rejected my, as he called it, biological determinism. So let me begin the answer by emphasising that I am not a biological determinist. I did say through the lecture that culture does have an influence and can have an influence and continues to have an influence, and I think simply that biology plays an important role that the left generally has overlooked and that we need to recognise. Concerning, I don't want to go too much into the history of the Russian Revolution, but while there's a lot of interest in Trotsky's analyses of bureaucracy, I don't think it was that led Trotsky to put down the rebellion at Kronstadt, and I would see that as an important part of exercising the authoritarianism and hierarchy of the Russian Revolution that later made it possible for Stalin.
I'm not sure why you think that tit-for-tat is a programme for the Darwinian left. My reading of Axelrod is that it's a very middle class process, in that you you offer the hand of friendship to people and they hopefully offer it back. Thank you. But after experience, you realise that some people are never going to be able to offer you anything. And what is the point of continuing to offer friendship to an underclass?
Right. I don't think the tit for tat is I don't think the tit for tat is so left in the sense that it's.
Yeah, I think this one is. Should I turn that off, perhaps? See if that's causing the feedback, my roving mic.
I don't think that tit for tat is left or working class in itself. I think it can be used by the left or the working class, if you like. I think it can be used effectively. But I agree, and in fact I mentioned in the talk, there is this problem of disparity of power and influence. And I can see, therefore, why you suggest that it's rather middle class. I think what it does is to set out a program for the left of creating structures in which those who are powerless or dispossessed can participate cooperatively, have something to offer. And let me just say, the fact that you're, if you like, without property or wealth certainly doesn't mean that you don't have anything to offer. I think that's a mistake. You may have lots of things to offer. And indeed, in a sense, some of them even could be negative. If you're powerless and dispossessed and forced to resort to crime in order to make your way in the world, clearly you have something to offer the wealthy, and that's not to steal their property. Sure. Take someone from the balcony, right up there. Yeah.
I'll have to try and shout from up here. Two queries of what you were saying. One was the you equated cooperative behaviour with altruism. And yet I think your example, your prison of honor example, basically show not any indication of altruism, but that self-interest can be better served by cooperative behaviour rather than altruistic behaviour. And that relates to my second question too, which is that you say we should have structures that promote cooperation rather than competition. But the assumption there is that most situations in which we find ourselves, therefore, are prisoner's dilemma situations, where actually cooperation is the best way to promote our self-interest. Whereas actually, as Adam Smith would say, that most situations are actually situations where competition is more likely to promote the public good than is cooperation.
Well, whether most situations are the one or the other, I don't really know that I could speculate on. I certainly think there are both kinds of situations. As for whether, I mean, it's perfectly true, as you point out, that in the prisoner's dilemma, or if you're using tit for tat, it's not really altruism. It's sometimes referred to as reciprocal altruism, but if the payoff is better for you. But you might, in the ordinary sense of altruism, not the sense used in evolutionary theory, you might be altruistically motivated. That is, if the prisoners in the original prisoner's dilemma actually were concerned about each other's welfare, genuinely concerned about each other's welfare, then they would have chosen the cooperative outcome for that reason alone, and they would have both been better off. So it may be that in the ordinary sense of altruism, rather than the sense used in evolutionary theory, you do want to promote altruism, and it'll turn out that people are better off as well, which I think is a nice outcome. Up against the wall there, Prince?
I'm thinking about this sort of tit for tat and the sort of natural incentive structure that provides people with to cooperate for mutual benefit. And it strikes me that the possibility of retaliation, as you said, is a very important feature of that. Well, if you look at the way decision making in a modern corporation is handled, we have what's called limited legal liability, which means that when a corporation does something that's not in citizens' best interests, polluting or whatever, that the individual who makes the decision to do that is protected from direct retaliation. And it seems to me that we've almost set up a social technology that makes it very difficult for us to operate in our natural way. That really, in this kind of economic system, we're operating within a bizarre incentive system.
I think that's an interesting point, and I think you're quite right that often that will be the case. I suppose you might say that for your corporation to be seen as a bad citizen, to have an Exxon Valdez disaster staining your name probably isn't something that most CEOs would regard as good for them either, although certainly they get off a lot more lightly than they would if they were really personally responsible. Yes. This gentleman in the middle there, yeah.
Biological forces and social forces. Are we not in danger of underestimating the power of the human race's use of tools and social organization in creating an immense barrier between humans and nature? After all, the Darwinians might imagine that it was the growth of brain size that allowed man to use tools, but Engels thought it was the other way around, that it was the use of tools that allowed Australopithecus, or apes as he called them, to develop brain size. And some time ago, Richard Leakey found an Australopithecus specimen in conjunction with tools, and Australopithecus has a small brain, which at least is suggestive evidence that Engels was right and Darwin was wrong. Perhaps on that particular point, only being suggestive, I realize, not conclusive proof. So what is the balance to be struck in estimating the forces of tools and society against nature? And then secondly, on the question of cooperation, I think you seem very right if you examine, for example, the way that wolves cooperate with each other in hunting dangerous herds of cattle. They don't individually hunt, but go in packs, and they have tactics which they use to get the cattle. And then, of course, the cattle also cooperate with each other because they can't individually beat a wolf, so they stampede and kill the marauding wolves like that. But what never happens in that class society is the cooperation of the wolves with the cattle.
Right. Okay. I don't really know much about the first question about the role of tools in evolution, so I won't say much about that, except that I know that it didn't happen the way Engels described it, because Engels' description is Lamarckian, and I think that's clearly wrong. But there could be an account consistent with Darwinian views of evolution, I guess, in which tools played a role. I just think I have to leave that one aside. The thrust of your the second question, I guess, maybe goes to that point that I put up on the transparency about my suggestion about part of the left being that we have an altered relationship with non-human animals. And you're right to point out, I guess, that by and large this doesn't happen in other species. You could put aside some species of symbiotic cooperation, you know, cleaner fish and so on, but let's leave that out. I don't think it has much to do with what we're really talking about. The difference, of course, is that we do, as humans, have greater capacity to reflect and think morally. And I don't think, you know, anyone ought to deny that. And that makes differences to the way we can act as moral agents.
doesn't the fact that an animal can't be a moral agent, though, doesn't have anything to do with whether it ought to be a moral patient, whether it ought to be the object of our duties or be regarded as having rights or however you wish to put it. So, sure, there is a difference here. I don't deny that. But I don't think it makes... it's not a difference that makes all the difference on these questions.
I think this will have to be the last question because it's a fairly tight schedule for Peter Singer.
Choice now.
Take
the gentleman.
Yes. I mean, does it mean now that we've got a future of capitalism to live under? It just seems to me that you know, your whole ideology is really appealing to that old chestnut of appealing to the enlightened self-interest of the rich or the ruling class. And I mean, you sort of downgrade political revolution, but I mean, what does that mean in terms of the future then?
Well, I guess I do think it means for the foreseeable future we are going to have some form of capitalist economy. Yes, I just cannot see successful alternative to that. I think for the foreseeable future, which I guess is what I'm talking about, the left has to work for ways of reducing the misery that that form of economic system results in for huge numbers of people in the world. And I think we have to try to do something about that and to work within that, much as we might like to have a better and different society. But I can't see a realistic prospect of producing that society. I can't see the future indefinitely, and I don't know, you know, where you might want to go in not just decades, but centuries. But in the decades to come anyway, I guess that is the future that I would see as the one we have to accept and work within.
I'm sorry to disappoint so many frustrated questioners, but I think we do have to finish. The fact there are so many frustrated questioners is an indication of the interest aroused by the talk. I'd like to thank Professor Singer again for coming to the LSE this evening. Thanks very much.